welcome to Talking Walking, hosted by Andrew Stuck from Rethinking Cities and the Museum of Walking. Talking Walking brings you interviews with people from the world of walking, artists, activists, professionals, and those of us who have a passion for just taking a walk. It's hard to find anyone more enthusiastic in revealing the hidden histories of London while walking around its back streets than Tom Hall. Once you learn he's editorial director and, as he says, London office general manager of Lonely Planet Guides, you realise that maybe everyone there is similarly inclined. Office moves to new locations are often disruptive, but Tom took it as an opportunity to share his enthusiasm for local history and organise lunchtime staff walks through the local streets. I join him one lunchtime, not on any particular route, as we wander around trying to find less noisy streets on which to record this interview. Whether in Istanbul or in Rome, his two favourite destinations for urban walking, Tom likes taking a stroll to explore and uncover the less obvious lived histories of city streets. Well, we're weaving our way through a little bit of London that I'm not all that familiar with. Tell us where we are and why it's is of interest to you.
Well, the first thing I'd say is it is of great interest to me. It wasn't always, actually. We're walking through Bankside down towards what you might call Old Borough, in just south of the river, just at the south end of Blackfriars Bridge. And I'm a North Londoner. I grew up in sort of Zone 4 badlands of North London. And as a North Londoner, I sometimes have been guilty of not paying South London due attention. In my job at Lonely Planet Guides, I've had calls to do that with quite a lot of intensity over the past 18 months. The reason for that is that we moved our office here to Blackfriars Road. We'd been owned by the BBC. We spent a period of time in White City, before that in various areas on the north side of the river. And I'm about as close to having a general manager in our London office as Lonely Planet has. We're quite an informal organisation. But when we moved here, we'd not only had this period as being part of the BBC, where we'd been part of something bigger, we also had had a shorter period of time where we had no office at all, where people were working remotely. And so when we came together here again in May of last year, we didn't really have that sort of spirit of togetherness that myself and a few others wanted. And while that can happen organically over time, we tried to find ways to just on a regular basis bring people together. Now, there's a few ways you can do that. You can take them all to the pub, but that would cost us quite a lot of money if we did that all the time. We'd never get any work done. But also, I found it a really exciting thing to be right here. From our office, you can see the great ancient heart of the city. But Lonely Planet's always been about looking underneath, looking at the details, the bits that other people miss. And it seemed to me that here was a real repository of interesting stuff, of history, of stories, of people's real lives versus the monumental things that you were finding on the other side of the river. So I started just at lunchtimes offering to take people out for a bit of a walk.
And this was really because you wanted to explore the area just as much as creating glue in the office.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that if you said to people, OK, we're going to put you all in Oxford Circus, people might have a view about that area, maybe even somewhere like Soho or possibly Clerkenwell. But here, it felt like an area that nobody really knew and that we were all a bit curious about. And there was, you know, so much to go at, but where do you start? So I tried to kind of bite off just tiny chunks of it, the idea being, what could we explore in an hour, including walking time? Maybe that's a good way to do it. Now, I didn't really think anyone would be terribly interested in this. You know, people are very nice and they're very polite.
You're the boss.
But someone who also, at least within LP, has a reputation, I think, of being a bit of a history nerd, a bit of a sato. I think my own personal biases have informed some of the walks that we've done. I think the first point to make about these sort of, I don't know what you call them, lunchtime rambles or something like that, was my colleague Laura said to me, why don't you just do this and have a go? And I thought, you know what, if five people turn up, or if two people turn up, and we go and do something, I've got out the office for a bit and that's nice, and maybe we've all learnt something together, and that's a good thing. And then as time's gone on, we've had a growing number of people coming along who seem to quite enjoy it because they then ask for other ones and have suggestions about them. And also, we're an international business and people come from other offices. It's a real delight, actually, that people come in and that maybe they're here, you know, for a visit from a finance team or a sales team, something like that. And they come in and they say, well, have you got some time to go and just ramble around a little bit? Because I heard it was quite fun. So it's slightly become something that is a part of, hopefully, the fabric of this place. I mean, if I can just example...
OK, this is All Hallows Garden.
All Hallows Garden on Copperfield Street. It's a great example of something that you happen across simply by walking. Now, I found this place. It's not really in any books of London history. It's midpoint between our office and the old Marshalsea prison site, just on the other side of Borough Road. The situation here, I think, is very emblematic of the area. So you've got the Shard rising out, but you've also got a little bit of green space, which is quite unusual. Some old little old workers' cottages, which actually still have some little old people in them. And then on further inspection, there are things that I find of real deep interest here. There's a remnant of an old World War II bomb site just here, which is almost unique. There aren't very many of those left. But this church is no longer a church. It's actually a recording studio. And this recording studio is where Depeche Mode recorded I Just Can't Get Enough. Which is, you know, that was just an amazing piece of information for me. And when we brought down here, I think we had about 20 people that day. And I think they were expecting me to ramble on in a fairly dull fashion about the architecture of this church. And I was able to say, well, just imagine a young Dave Gahan here cranking out one of the classic songs of the 1980s. And great, you know, that's a fun thing and an unusual thing. And it's everywhere here.
OK, so you've mentioned Lonely Planet two or three times. And, yeah. and listeners are going to say, well, hang on a moment. What does this guy expect? You know, it must be an office full of people like you. It's a huge brand in the travel guide business and more besides. I'm sure you'll tell us more. But to me, I mean, I'm just assuming that everyone works there is actually hot desking it to rush off somewhere else. The one thing they're really interested in is, as you say, getting under the skin of places and discovering things. Not necessarily on foot. Maybe we should get to that at one point as well, but...
Well, I think in the first instance, the image that people have of someone working for Lonely Planet very much fits the mentality that you get. And it's true of everyone from someone who, you know, is coming in just to do some freelance editing work to someone who works in IT for us to someone who's working in a marketing position or something like that. You know, we're a normal company to all intents and purposes with normal people in the roles, but there is that thing that brings everyone together, which is a love of travel, which in its base element, I think, is a love of exploring and finding things that are a bit different and going, we have this phrase, two streets over. You will find that most people will walk down the main drag, the Rambler in Barcelona or Champs-Élysées or, you know, whatever it is. And we say, look, you know, you're going to find more things that are of interest with fewer people there to discover them if you do go two streets over. I think that suits walking extremely well. Obviously, if you're walking, you're moving at a human pace. Things catch your eye, hopefully. And this is the other thing I think is a coming challenge for Lonely Planet and for other people is the way in which you see things when you travel now is through the prism of a mobile phone. I'm taking this photo and I'm sharing it. There are really wonderful things about that, but one of the things that is a bit of a worry for me, your phone is buzzing at you and you open it up and you da, 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 da. You're not going to see some of the details that you find on the buildings around here. And I think the architecture of Bankside and Borough is another wonderful bonus from just rambling around here, because there are some big headline things that you can stop and see. There's fascinating churches and there's gardens and there's sites associated with Dickens and there's real tangible history here. But there's also, I think, this sense that it's an area where people live and have lived and have lived and worked. If you go over the river to the City of London, the history is, it's all around you and it's overwhelming. But it's not somewhere that people have really lived for quite a long time. Whereas here, you know, we're walking past, council housing.
Yeah, you can hear the children playing in the playground.
And, you know, all of those things are hugely rewarding. And funny enough, you get a combination of the two here. Charles Dickens Primary School is on the site where Dickens himself lived. One of the things that's been wonderful about these walks is, you know, you do them by kind of going along a bit like this and maybe there's five or six people with you and sometimes more as you're walking around. You're talking to one person as you're going from place to place. You stop at a point of interest and you speak a little bit about it. But it's done by walking around corners, you know? We didn't see Charles Dickens Primary School as we were coming down here, but now we do.
Well, the other advantage, we could actually hear it. I think often, for me, it's now more and more people are in their cars or have headphones on. The point is they're sealed within.
Yes.
And they don't hear the ambience around them. And there was a classic example. We were two streets away. You started talking about, well, the great difference here about here in the city was that people actually live in this area, and we started to hear the children playing in the playground,
yes.
And yet we hadn't actually encroached or even got within sight of the playground.
But the idea of these subtle sounds, the noise of children in a playground, the bell clanging, a solitary taxi sweeps around a corner, versus the overwhelming noise, either that you put in headphones, and you choose to subject yourself to, choose to enjoy an experience. There's a calming element to that, because, I mean, you know, if you permit me a moment's reflection, I mean, one of the things that struck me when I was thinking about talking to you and doing this walk was how this combination of learning about a place that you find yourself in purely by chance, really, and at the same time trying to explore that on foot in quite snatched moments. I've got 20 minutes, okay, I'm going to go out and do a bit of thinking because we're doing this walk next week, versus what I do every day. You know, it's a bit of a sort of ragbag jumble of a job, and everyone's busy, and you know, I'm sure most people's is like that. You suddenly find yourself in a moment of quiet and calmness, like right here. Very quiet on some innocuous streets, but you know there's lots of interest around you. It's good for the brain, and walking is obviously good for the body as well. So it works in a few different ways, that. And that's an interesting notion, I think, yeah.
Let's just try and find out what you actually do.
Sure, okay. Lonely Planet is a big, small company. We've got about 350 employees, but I think we're trying to do dozens and dozens of different things all at the same time. So we've got the guidebooks business that most people are familiar with, and website. We make a lot of things like big photo books and reference and how-to travel guides, things like that. But we also do video. We do lots and lots of different things. And we're in the middle of these changing trends around how people travel, how people buy books, how people consume information, you know, people's concerns about safety, about the way in which technology is developing. We're sort of right in the middle of all of those things, and both responding to them and being a part of those changes is a constant part of the day-to-day. So I look after a whole editorial operation. We've got both a team of editors who are commissioning all of our content, and we've also got a team of people who are producing articles and videos and things like that for our website. And I also look after our sort of brand and marketing team. So they're trying to tie all of that together and present it to the world in a way that makes sense. So there's two quite discrete parts to it, and then a third part, which is really just trying to be someone who's an on-the-ground manager of the London operation, and our London office has got 85 people in it. So there's three different elements to that. I try to sort of, you know, explain how that came to be and how I came to be in that position. It's really a process of grabbing hold of the bottom of the rung and hanging on for dear life and then seeing where it leads you. I started work at Lonely Planet after university. I went travelling. I'm quite curious about how things are made and put together, and I love history and I love the written word and I love books. And I had these travel guides. I was going around South America.
So you were the lucky bloke, were you?
The lucky guy. I mean, I wrote...
Because, I mean, there must have been dozens of people. I mean, there must be even hundreds of people every day who kind of think, well, I could turn out this kind of stuff. Yeah. I'd like to turn out this kind of stuff. I'd love to work for an outfit like Lonely Planet.
A huge element of fortune in that I wrote letters to maybe 20 different publishing companies, and I said, "Give us a job." And Lonely Planet at the time was expanding, and a lady called Charlotte Hindle phoned me up, and she said, "Would you like to come and pack books in our warehouse for whatever money it was an hour?" And the two things that were interesting about that was that, you know, I didn't think when I walked in there in 1999, A, I'd still be working here, and B, I'd be doing what I am doing. But also, the first person that I met when I walked in there that day is now my wife and the mother of my three children. So if it was so Lonely Planet is bound up very much in who I am. And so there's good fortune all over the place there. I also think that period of time, the last sort of 15 plus years, have been that period of remarkable change in publishing, in media, in technology, in travel. For, you know, Ryanair were just starting. They were just starting to do what they were doing. We didn't really have... The internet was not universal, it was not widespread.
I would have imagined that most of the Lonely Planet purchasers and readers of Lonely Planet, even 20 years ago, might be doing some long-haul flights, but most of the rest of the time they were travelling on the ground train, hitching, car travel, cycling or whatever, not doing frequent small flights, which I'm assuming is now much more the trend.
That was a huge factor in Lonely Planet developing from being a publisher that was seen as, if you're going to Southeast Asia, if you were going to Sub-Saharan Africa, South America, that was the thing. That we're still very known for that, but that people are popping off for 3 days, 4 days, 5 days to Florence or to Barcelona or somewhere like that. In that initial blast, that helped us really to grow and also to establish ourselves in other places. So Lonely Planet was a very, very niche publisher when I started in America. It's now the market leader in the States. And to the extent that we're seen as being so synonymous with travel that one of Barack Obama's first acts upon the election of Donald Trump was to turn around and get in touch with us and say, I want to write a piece for you about how important it is to travel and explore the world and the role of young people in it. Well, that was an absolutely gobsmacking moment for me. Here we were with the leader of the free world knocking on our door and saying, the first thing that I want to do is talk to your audience. That was something that for everyone who works at Lonely Planet, it was a moment to sit back and go, wow, that's amazing. Now, that in itself doesn't do anything for your bottom line.
Yeah.
It's something that made me feel very personally proud of what we were doing all day. I thought, oh, that's a step in the right direction. So yeah, that was great.
I want you to suggest a couple of walks.
Okay.
They could be in North London, they could be around here, they could be in Timbuktu, you know,
sure,
because someone who works at Lonely Planet will be expected to come up with some favourite overseas. Matt, what is your favourite overseas destination?
My favourite destination in the world, my favourite place in the world is Istanbul, which is a fabulous walking city, though not many people go there to do that. Istanbul is layer on layer, millennia of history. But it hides it and it preserves it. It's not a place where I think you go, okay, I'm going to go and these are the five things I'll see on my walk. But you just slowly meander through a particular district and take your time because it's hilly and you need to stop for cups of tea. But I've been walking for 5 minutes, I'm feeling a bit tired, and oh, there's the Aqueduct of Valens, and I'll go through here and just the most striking mosque designed by Sinan, it just strikes you like that. And then there's a beautiful view of the Bosphorus and the Golden Horn, and so you've got this combination of the visual and you get beautiful cities. Sydney is beautiful, Cape Town is beautiful, Rio is beautiful. But nowhere quite combines history and that sense of Istanbul. There's actually a brilliant book which is called Strolling Through Istanbul by a man who lived there for many years. And it just takes you through the different districts and around the different hills of the city. Istanbul is a real treat of a place and it needs repeated visits. But pack your walking boots, I would say.
A couple of favourite walks, would one be in Istanbul?
A couple of great walks. Number one, a really fabulous walk is to go through Rome, which is another vibrant and vital city, and maybe get the metro to somewhere like the Circus Maximus, and then just thread your way through the old medieval city. People go to Rome for the ancient stuff, of course they do, but the medieval heart, go walking around the Campo di Fiori and places like that, is such a treat, and it still feels so Roman and earthy and like full of this Italian life that you just dream about when you think of the city, and that's there. So that would be one suggestion. The other one is a walk that I've done a lot of times here over the course of this year. So it sums up what walking around London is for me, is across Blackfriars Bridge, south to north, then you cut up through the old precinct of the Blackfriars, then you go through some old preserved medieval lanes, which are hardly preserved, you know, some of them are almost encased in 1980s office buildings, and then you pop out on Ludgate Hill at St Paul's and probably stop by Paul's Cross or something like that. That is a short walk of probably half or three quarters of a mile, but it frames, I think, everything that I'd like to show someone who's never been to London before. And you get the river, you get this sense of grandeur, but you also get the chance to explain how people lived in it and the impact of some of the things that have happened through history. So that would be my other one. I feel very lucky in many ways to A, feel lucky to live in London, and I feel lucky to be able to explain to people why, because lots of people don't get it. They think that it's big and smelly and busy, and you know, why would you want to spend so much time here and certainly so much time learning about it? But I think that does explain it rather well. That's why I like doing that.
Are you a tourist in your own town?
I guess I am. I mean, maybe I'm a combination of a sort of over-enthusiastic tourist and a sort of hack tour guide. I mean, you know, I'm going to hold my hands up. There's no blue badge here, and I'm grabbing my information from a handful of books I've got at home and lots of enthusiasm. But
also probably from the people you walk with, because one of them will observe or experience a place differently to you.
They will, and one of the things that's especially lovely is when someone's got a personal anecdote which they're prepared to bring to the party and share, and then it becomes a little bit more of a conversation. And I love that, because the thought is at the back of your mind, which is, you know, are there people who are sitting in the office and going, oh, I've got to go on this walk? You know, it's non-compulsory, very much non-compulsory. But we're in what is the Geraldine Harmsworth Park surrounding the Imperial War Museum, and it's actually where Lonely Planet comes down to play its five-a-side football some Friday afternoons.
I come here because of the tree trail, and we run all sorts of walks around the tree trail.
Right, that's interesting.
And I did one this summer, which was around composing haiku.
Really?
And it was great success. It was bitterly cold day, I have to be honest. Probably colder than today, which is absurd. 6th of June it was, but it was really cold. But it's a fantastic setting. They've got a community orchard, they've got this tree trail, they've got the games areas that you talk about, and you know, you've got loads and loads of history around and plenty of places just to sit and contemplate the world a bit.
And you have a little bit more of a sense of space than if we were standing outside the Natural History Museum. I mean, you know, the Imperial War Museum is a world-class place. It's a fabulous, fabulous destination, fabulous museum, and it's, you know, the sort of place that, you know, we'd always be including in our guide. It also, I think, has this feeling of somewhere you have to work a little bit harder to get to. And I like the idea of someone who, as a tourist, has maybe done the big sights and been through the crowds at the Tower of London and, you know, the London Eye and things like that, and then comes down here and breathes out a little bit. Because I feel like I breathe out a little bit when I'm here. And on one of the occasions we were here, I figured this was as close as we were going to get to Kennington Oval. And I wanted to talk a bit about the Oval, an interesting place with a fabulous sporting history. And I was talking about the first FA Cup final, noting that Wanderers won the first FA Cup final. And one of my colleagues put her hand up and said, well, I play for Wanderers FC now. I just thought that was it was a fabulous thing, because, you know, Wanderers, I conjure up this image of this sort of incredibly remote Victorian sporting view of football, which is totally different to really the game that we play now. And yet the continuity there, by chance, I found really rather enjoyable, I have to say. I got a bit of fun out of that.
You've been listening to Talking Walking, brought to you by Rethinking Cities and the Museum of Walking. In this episode, you've heard from Tom Hall. If you have any views on this interview or any walking issues, we would love to hear from you. Just follow the links on the Talking Walking website. We look forward to having you along for future episodes of Talking Walking. Written, recorded and produced by Andrew Stuck of Rethinking Cities Limited, our artwork is designed by Ian Martin of Aardvark Graphics, and the music is composed by Simon Sanders of Easytronic.